Hello, microbe friends. I'm Dr. Justine Dees, and welcome to the Joyful Microbe Podcast. It's the show all about the microbes we encounter in our daily lives. Thank you so much for tuning in. I can't wait to share this show with you. While many microbes bring benefits, and they are the usual focus for the podcast, we can't ignore the impact of pathogens when it comes to food safety. It's a topic worth covering because it impacts us on a daily basis. So, this episode is all about enjoying chicken, whether you buy chicken or eggs from the store, or raise your own chickens in your backyard. Today, I'm chatting with Dr. Andrea Etter, who is an assistant professor specializing in food microbiology and food safety at the University of Vermont. This conversation has a ton of info, both foundational knowledge as well as practical tips that will help you in your daily life. We talk about Dr. Etter's background and path to food microbiology, food safety from the grocery store to meal consumption, common pathogens like Salmonella and Campylobacter in chicken, the risks of those bacteria and prevention strategies, handling and food safety of raw store-bought chicken, and the microbial risks of backyard chickens and tips for safe raising practices. As you listen to this episode, it will be easy to begin to fear the microbial world. Keep in mind that knowledge empowers informed choices. So, understanding the different types of chicken-associated microbes and their risks allows us to prioritize safe handling practices. But be sure to balance this knowledge with the fact that many microbes are essential for health. Microbes are still amazing, despite the risks of some. All right, let's get on to the interview. Hi, Andrea. Thanks so much for coming on the Joyful Microbe Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. I think this is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think so too. So you're an assistant professor researching food microbiology and food safety at the University of Vermont, and we're going to mostly focus on chicken. But what I love is that you also have a passion for communicating these food safety risks to the public and helping scientists do a better job of spreading this information to consumers. So you're here to do just that today, and I'm excited to dig in. But first, how did you get interested in microbiology, and what was your path to food microbiology and food safety?
Well, it was kind of a long path, actually. I did not go to college initially planning to do science, and certainly not to become a professor. My mom's a nurse, and my dad has an undergrad in chemistry. And we moved out to rural Wisconsin when I was about six and started home studying a little ahead of the curve, I think. Yeah, so really being a professor never crossed my mind. Didn't really seem achievable. It also didn't seem like something I'd really be interested in. It just, I don't know, it didn't click. But I did really like science. There's a picture of me somewhere. I was homeschooled and I was probably five in this picture. And we're at a homeschool fair. And my dad is doing a demo of dissecting frogs, mail order frog. And my older sister is standing there with this expression of like, ew, gross. And I'm like leaning in, like fascinated. so that was probably the first sign that, science was going to be something I really enjoyed. And one of the cool parts about homesteading, you raise a lot of your own food. And we would raise animals for meat. And because my dad is a very curious person himself, when we were doing the butchering, he would point out things to me like, oh, here's, the chicken heart has, I don't remember how many chambers, I should know this. But a deer heart ha or a sheep heart has a different number of chambers, and the liver has a different number of lobes. And I just thought that was fascinating. So for me, butchering was really like dissection practice. And I just loved that. And we had a good homeschool curriculum for high school. I did science with the same curriculum with my sister, who was 2 years ahead. My mom very cleverly sold it as being more convenient, not, Andrea is better at science than Joanna or something. So I guess I wasn't maybe the most astute child. I didn't really pick up that maybe I was gifted in science at that point. But I would do all the dissections. Famously, my mom threatened to fail my older sister on high school biology if she didn't at least touch the worm that we were dissecting. Very big difference there. Like, she wanted nothing to do with it. I thought it was amazing. But I actually went to college to study nursing because nursing sounded really practical, and I knew I liked science. And there's an applied part of science to nursing. And I thought it'd be a good life plan. I lasted in nursing for about a year. At the end of my freshman year, I was having some serious doubts about whether nursing was what I wanted to do for a couple of reasons. Really intense hours for the practicums that I felt would be pretty hard for me. And then I was really disappointed there weren't going to be any more science classes. There was like pathology, and that was all that was left after year one. I thought that was sad. Which should have been a sign. And I'm a more of a creative type than a super like detail-oriented organized type by nature. Like a lot of scientists, there's a bit of ADD that happens. And somebody pointed out that was not necessarily going to work super well with nursing, something about making sure the patients get the right medications and at the right times. So I had a bit of a come to Jesus moment. Looked through the course catalog, and from a very pragmatic standpoint, literally, I was like, okay, well, if I study biology, all my nursing courses transfer. And they had like a careers section, and one of them was Science Illustrator. And I'd always liked drawing, so I was like, okay, this makes sense. I can do that. I can take all these amazing science courses, and I can do science illustration. And so that was what I did. And so I transferred to biology and planned to do that. It's like a 1 year course or certificate, usually after college. Keep in mind, I had no formal art training, so this was possibly not very realistic, but I didn't realize that. But anyway, I ended up starting to tutor for the tutoring center, the learning assistance center, and I realized I really love teaching. And that maybe it made more sense to think about getting a master's and teaching science. But I wasn't very ambitious, so I thought I was going to like teach at a community college. My academic advisor talked me into getting a PhD on the grounds that the stipend was better. And it was easier to switch from a PhD to a master's than the reverse. And in my pragmatic little Midwestern brain, that made a ton of sense. So I applied to grad school for PhDs. I didn't really have any research experience, not a recommended route, and really not a possible route anymore. But it was at the time. Grad school has gotten a lot more competitive at this point. I got in a couple of places. Purdue felt like home, so I started an interdisciplinary life sciences program with rotations, and joined a microbiology lab at the end of my first year. And that wasn't the one I ended up graduating from. It wasn't a good fit with me and the advisor. And so partway through my second year, I ended up needing to look for a new lab. Not the most common scenario, but not uncommon. And I had a classmate who was in the nutrition and food sciences department doing food microbiology. And he told me that his boss had an opening to start, this was probably November, to start in January for a PhD student. And so I applied for that, and that ended up being where I finished my PhD, and it was a really amazing fit, because I love microbiology, and there's part of me that really loves like the curiosity-driven bits that are just, we're going to study this because it's cool and we don't know how it works. But I also have this really strong, like, I want my work to be useful and I want it to make a difference in people's lives. And food microbiology fit that really well. So we're studying bacteria that make people sick, and we're trying to figure out how they work so that fewer people get sick. And so that was a really happy place for me. So that's roughly how I ended up in food microbiology. Long and torturous and possibly not recommended.
I think a lot of people's paths are not direct to a PhD. And then after the PhD, mine certainly wasn't. So I relate to that. But I think it's really neat that you were homeschooled and that your dad took the time to use just like even just butchering as a way to teach you about biology. That's really cool. And I mean, it emphasizes how important hands-on experiences are for kids to really grasp science and then appreciate it as well and get excited about it.
Right. I mean, and some of it's personal interest because I don't really recall any of my siblings sticking around for these things. Certainly not my older sister, but I feel like maybe my younger sister did a little bit, but yeah, I was the one who was like, oh, wow, this is super cool. Let me, you know, just vacuum this up and, like, absorb it.
Yeah. Yep. And I think if there's an interest there, it's a great way to cultivate it for kids. And I'm sure it was really nice of your dad to do that because, you know, it's like when you're taking the time to teach a child something, it adds to the labor of it. So, you know, it's nice of your dad to do that.
And
be generous in that way.
I'm not sure what motivated him. I think he thought it was really cool, which is actually the best way to teach kids. So I think he was just happy to have an audience.
So did you ever do anything with a science illustration?
Well, not yet. I was actually... One project I'd like to do eventually is, at this point, I've got a lot of projects or a couple of projects that kind of go back to homesteading and thinking about food safety and keeping people safe from some of the zoonotic, the pathogens that are common in animals people have on homesteads. And one of those projects looks at common... So salmonella and another one that most people haven't heard of, campylobacter, which are commonly found in poultry. And so one of the things I'd like to do eventually, and I don't know when I'm going to get back to this, is make a coloring book on backyard poultry and the bacteria that live in them with some information. And
That's a great idea.
Yeah, I just I need to make it actually happen.
Yeah.
One of these days.
Yeah,
I had like 3 illustrations and then got really busy.
Well, we'll look forward to that. I think that will be great.
I have a couple coloring pages. I just need to caption them. I could give them to you to put on your website. you want.
Yeah, that would be awesome. And I, you mentioned homesteading, and that's going to link back to some of the stuff that we're going to talk about with raising chickens. But first, could you paint a picture of how food safety or lack thereof can impact our daily lives from the moment we shop for groceries to the last bite of a meal?
Yeah, so there's a lot of places that food safety can enter the food chain. We talk about farm to fork food safety a lot of times in my field. So I think one experience that sort of really drove this home was after I finished my PhD, I was briefly living in Seattle, and it was a summer and fall where for some reason there was just this huge rash of outbreaks related to lettuce. Lettuce is grown out in fields, and those fields are often irrigated from open canals. And it was a time period where we were just starting to realize that if the water you're watering your lettuce with is full of pathogens like Salmonella and Chickatoxigenic E. coli or Listeria, those pathogens sometimes don't just stay on the surface of the lettuce where they can be washed off, and they can cause illness. I felt like every time I went to the grocery store that year to buy romaine lettuce, I'd get home and I'd see that there was another outbreak on Twitter, posted on Twitter, that the FDA was looking at. So that summer, I kind of stopped eating lettuce for a while because I just kept having to throw it out. Because there are a few pathogens you just don't mess around with. And Chickatoxigenic E. coli, the risk of kidney failure is not worth it. So that was a really interesting experience for me because I knew about these pathogens and that was actually affecting my grocery shopping.
Yeah, that's a good point. So let's talk a little bit more specifically about chicken. What microbes should people be aware of in chicken when they purchase it from the store that could cause foodborne illness? And what are the key factors contributing to their presence in chicken products?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think everyone is sort of aware of this, but we kind of don't always, like, actually take account of this. But chicken, raw chicken from the grocery store is not a sterile product. And that sounds obvious, but there's a lot of data that a lot of people know this intellectually, but maybe don't actually take care of raw chicken in a way that would indicate that. So there's a couple of different bacteria that get along really well with chickens, but not so well with us. And those are Salmonella and Campylobacter. And neither of those... Well, you can sell chicken that has either of those in it. Our food safety regulation says that while you aren't supposed to have a ton of it present in your poultry, it's okay as long as only, I think, 2 out of 50 chickens on the processing line are testing positive for Salmonella. I think they just changed the regulations for Campylobacter, and I don't know those off the top of my head. But it's not going to be super common, but if we're thinking about 2 out of 50, that's about 4% of poultry that's in theory going to have Salmonella. And Salmonella, there's a lot of different types of it, and they carry different risks. But in general, if you get Salmonella, it's going to be several days to a week of unpleasantness. So think worst case of stomach flu you've ever gotten, except it's going to be more diarrheal. And you may need antibiotics, and children under the age of 5 are especially susceptible to getting more severe illness from salmonella because their immune systems aren't quite as effective. And they're small, so it's easy for them to get dehydrated. So salmonella could be on the surface of the chicken. Historically, like cut up chicken rather than whole chicken has more salmonella because we have one chicken at a time and the risk for any individual chicken is pretty low. But cut up chicken, you're mixing all of those chickens into a giant bin and they're sharing their salmonella. We have regulations for the amount, the percentage of parts that are allowed to test positive for salmonella. And so there has been a lot of improvement on that, but it's still relatively common. Bone-in chicken is going to be slightly riskier than something like boneless chicken breast, just because it's thicker and the bones affect how things cook. The biggest ways that a person can protect themselves from getting salmonella or campylobacter from raw chicken would be don't wash your chicken in the sink. I don't know why, but I always washed chicken in the sink growing up. It seemed like, well, the chicken's a little slimy and it will just make it a little bit cleaner and a little less gross. But really what you're doing when you wash the chicken or the turkey or whatever in the sink is you're taking all those bacteria that are on the surface of the chicken and you're spreading them all over your sink. And your sink is gonna potentially have produce in it or dishes. And unless you're bleaching your sink right after that, you've got a high risk of spreading that any salmonella or campylobacter that's on that poultry all over your sink, where it can potentially join other bacterial communities in the drain or in the scratches on the sink and live there quite happily for a long time. The other thing to think about is cutting boards. Wooden cutting boards are really hard to sanitize because they have a grainy surface and you can't really soak them in bleach without damaging the surface. They can tend to have cracks and things. Plastic cutting boards aren't bad. They do get scratches in them over time. By the time those scratches are visible, they're pretty deep. Bacteria are really small and they really like living in cracks. I've done some 3D microscopy of bacteria growing on stainless steel chips, essentially, so little circles. And things that you would never see looking at it, they're like canyons for the bacteria. Mm-hmm. And they just snuggle in there and attach themselves. And they're basically impossible to get out. But one of the key things is if you're going to cut up chicken, you really want to use a different cutting board and knife for the chicken than you're going to use for anything that's not going to be cooked later. Mm-hmm. If you only have one cutting board, cut up your fresh fruits and veggies first and then cut up your chicken because you don't really want to transfer any potential salmonella or campylobacter from your chicken onto your salad where it will not get cooked and will be, getting a uninhibited progress from the salad into your stomach.
So how long can salmonella or campylobacter survive on the cutting board? Let's say they're deep inside of one of those canyons in the plastic cutting board and they're, it's dried out. Like, can they survive in there for very long?
Oh, yes. There's been some studies that some types of salmonella, and it probably varies depending on the type, can survive for like a month on a dry surface. So, yes.
Yeah.
Just because it's dry doesn't mean those bacteria are dead. Bacteria can actually do this fun thing where they go into what we call a viable but non-culturable state, which means they're there, but they're kind of hibernating or dormant. Mm-hmm. And you might not be able to easily grow them if you were trying to, but somehow they can magically come out of that and make you sick.
Yeah. Give them the right environment.
Yeah. And we're not quite sure what the right environment is if we're trying to grow them back up, but
Yeah, if they get into us, yes. It becomes the right environment.
Apparently.
Yeah. Okay, so that's all really good. Let's say somebody has one cutting board.
Yes.
And they, like, how should they go about washing that cutting board if they've got a plastic one, it's, you know, got some cuts in it, so we know salmonella can survive in there. How should they go about washing it to make sure that the next time they use the cutting board, it's not going to be an issue?
Well, if your cutting board is old and warped and cracked, you should probably spend the $10 on Amazon to buy a new set. They have beautiful color-coded cutting boards on Amazon. I have a set of them. They're really not that expensive. But let's say you have a new cutting board and you want to keep this from happening, because once it's happened, it's really hard to get rid of it. You probably should just toss your cutting board. Realistically.
Mm-hmm.
My husband thinks I'm a bit crazy for this, but realistically, what you want to do is you want to clean any juices and meat bits off the cutting board, maybe with a paper towel or like a wipe of some sort. And then, or you could wash it with soap and water. And then you probably want to sanitize it. So if you can, you know, get all of the soap and water out of your sink and then plug the sink and put in a little bit of bleach diluted in water, and leave that for like 10 minutes, that'll work pretty well.
So,
and then rinse it off.
Okay, so you talked about not washing the chicken earlier. And I noticed that I started getting this a meal kit in the, you know, from the boxes, and I'm not going to name who it is just in case. But they don't tell you to wash the chicken, but they say to pat it with paper towels. So yeah. I'm curious, what do you think about that?
Well, as long as you're tossing the paper towels out and you have like your garbage can open and handy, so you're not like sticking your hands everywhere around the kitchen. Yeah, it's not a terrible idea. I played around with the meal kit a bit in the last year, and my bigger concern is that things aren't necessarily staying cold during transit, and so that might be a really good opportunity for bacteria to grow.
Mm-hmm.
The companies will claim that they have tested these things and they're definitely staying cold, but personal experience suggests that's not necessarily accurate.
Yeah. Well, that's definitely something to consider with that.
Yeah.
So why is it that Salmonella and Campylobacter can thrive on chicken in particular?
Yeah. So Salmonella is one of those bacteria that's really good at adapting to a lot of different niches in nature. So Salmonella you'll generally find in the intestines of chickens, but certain types can go and infect the ovaries as well. So sometimes it's not just the outside of the egg, but the inside. This isn't super common. There was a lot of work done on this in like the 90s in commercial egg production. And some breeds of chickens are more susceptible than others. For whatever reason, leghorns are considered susceptible. I really don't know of any other breeds that are considered extra susceptible, because I have looked for this. The intestines are a really good place for any bacterium to grow. There's a lot of nutrients, obviously. A lot of bacteria have certain proteins or genes that help them take advantage of the scenario in the intestines. Now, chickens generally, if they're infected as adults, won't hold on to Salmonella super long. They'll clear it because their body will recognize it as an invader. I don't have a lot of data on this, but a couple of different times we've tested backyard flocks and chicken. We've had one sample come back positive, and maybe we weren't, you know, there were four different barred rocks. And initially, we didn't have a method for telling barred rocks apart from, like, birds of the same breed apart from each other. We eventually went to using colored zip ties because we had this problem a few times. But usually by the time we process the samples, it's been 2 or 3 weeks, or process the samples and can get back to the farm to figure out which of the four barred rocks it is. We'll test all the barred rocks, and none of them will have salmonella. Which suggests that the adult chickens are pretty good at getting rid of salmonella out of their system. They can recognize that it's not something that's supposed to be there. When they get infected as babies, it's a little different. There is a fair amount of research that the first 3 days of a chick's life they're really susceptible to infection. Not surprising, it's kind of like babies. They're brand new. Their immune systems aren't up and running fully, and they don't have a lot of other bacteria living in their guts. So infection is pretty easy. Hatcheries, there can be a lot of fluff and broken eggshells, and it turns out the air actually in a lot of the brooders can have salmonella floating around in it, and so the chicks essentially acquire salmonella with some of their first breaths.
Wow.
And then they don't always clear it. It depends. I remember one study I read, like, most of them would have cleared it out of their intestines by the time they started laying eggs, but it was like, it was not all of them. It was maybe 60%. So for whatever reason, early exposure to salmonella can lead to lifelong infection.
Mm. Yeah. It's very interesting. Mm-hmm. I hadn't really thought about the chicken being actually infected. I just was thinking of it more like the chicken meat ends up with salmonella on it somehow. So what is it? I mean, do they actually get sick from it? Because you said as adults, they clear it. So it's kind of like, is it just a transient sort of thing? Or do they present any symptoms? So for adults or for the chicks?
You can't really tell. You know, when we're testing people's chickens, we'll be on the lookout for a chicken that seems sick. And I don't, you know, you can't go back in time and know, but we'll have tested flocks where there'll be some chickens that look kind of, and they're like, I wonder if that one's going to pop positive for salmonella. And then that chicken is negative, but a chicken that seems perfectly healthy, it's positive. Now, maybe the chicken that seems sick was sick a couple of weeks ago, and then they cleared it and gave it to everybody else, but we weren't there 3 weeks ago, so we don't know.
Yeah.
And as far as the chicks, no, they seem perfectly healthy. You know, we do a lot of sampling at agricultural supply stores in Vermont, and the chicks all seem healthy. And some of those stores, you know, you think you've got super healthy chicks, and 70% of those chick samples are coming back positive for salmonella. You're like, interesting.
Yeah. I guess in a way it makes sense that this is why salmonella is an issue for humans, because the chickens can carry it and have it either transiently or carry it for a lifetime, and it doesn't necessarily make them drastically ill, and so then it can get easily passed on to us who it does make ill.
Exactly, and especially with the chicks, I swear if you had been trying to develop a vehicle for giving salmonella to small children, you could not have come up with a better one than like, you look at them as an adult and you're like, oh, it's so cute and fluffy. I want to hold it and cuddle it and put it near my face. And that cute fluffy chick could very well be shedding salmonella, and they're not very clean. So even if they look cute and fluffy, their feet are maybe not very clean, and maybe their butts aren't very clean, and they're messy.
So when it comes to getting like a salmonella infection for us, is it more of an opportunistic pathogen where you're it's going to be people who are immunocompromised who will get salmonella, or is it like anybody can get it, you know, and it doesn't really matter your state of health?
It's definitely anybody, but some people will get it worse than others. So if you are a small child or over the age of 65 or immunocompromised, you might, you're at risk for a worse case of salmonella. Typically, salmonella is going to cause what we call gastroenteritis, which is GI symptoms, you know, diarrhea, vomiting, maybe a fever, a lot of cramps. But it'll last, you know, maybe 3 to 7 days and you'll get over it. Occasionally, salmonella will get out of the intestine and get into your bloodstream. And if that happens, then you're at risk for you're going to get septicemia or potentially meningitis, or you could get an infected joint. And different types of salmonella are better at this than others. Fortunately, one of the types that's really good at it and was really common in chicken meat about 10 years ago is now not common in chicken meat anymore due to a vaccine. I haven't seen it come up in the backyard poultry samples yet. We haven't tested most of them for the specific type of salmonella yet. But it does happen. Most types of salmonella, it's going to be like 5% of the cases you get complications, like a bloodstream infection. And you can also get like a wound infection, you know, if you have a chicken that like digs their claws into you. Their feet are really dirty. You should definitely take that seriously.
Yeah, that makes sense. So let's go back to when people go to purchase chicken in the store.
Sorry, can we go back to one other thing, Campylobacter? Because we talked a lot about salmonella.
Yeah, definitely. I would love to hear a little more about Campylobacter.
Campylobacter is actually different from salmonella for chickens because it is a normal part of their gut bacteria.
Okay.
So it won't make them sick. They won't recognize it as a pathogen. And if you introduce a bird with Campylobacter to your flock, all the other birds in that pen or who have contact with that bird are probably going to get Campylobacter.
Mm-hmm.
And it will only be in the gut or in fresh feces because it doesn't survive very well outside the chicken. And this is where Campylobacter drives me nuts. Because if you're trying to grow Campylobacter, it will probably not grow for you. But it is currently estimated to be the most common cause of foodborne illness in the U.S. So clearly it somehow manages to get from poultry or raw milk or other places that it's common into humans, despite the fact that it tends to be very fussy about growing in the lab. I think that Campylobacter is being kind of like the princess and the princess and the pea, like anything off and it's going to, you know, refuse to grow.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, can you tell us a little bit more about a Campylobacter infection for humans?
Yeah.
How's it similar or different from salmonella?
So typically the symptoms are...
Hey there. It's me, Justine, founder of Joyful Microbe. Guess what? I'm not just passionate about spreading microbiology joy through my podcast. I'm also interested in helping others create engaging scientific content. As a freelance science writer and editor with a PhD in microbiology, I bring a blend of scientific expertise and effective communication. No need to hire two people to get the job done. I've got it all covered. If you love what I've created on Joyful Microbe, imagine what we can do together for your project. Whether you're a life science company or an academic and need compelling content, I'm here to help. If you've got something in mind and want to chat about it, send me an email at justine@justinedees.com or check out my website, justinedees.com. Let's turn your ideas into awesome science content. Can't wait to collaborate with you. Now, back to the show.
Going to be overall milder. It is one of those that one of the reasons we don't hear about it as much is that a lot of times people don't get sick enough to go to the doctor. You know, they just might think they had a stomach bug and it'll get better. It tends to be a milder illness than Salmonella. Again, if you're talking about a small kid, though, all bets are off. One of the scary things, though, about Campylobacter is that for some people, it can cause autoimmune arthritis after infection.
Wow, that's a big
Yeah,
deal.
it is. So yeah, if you have like chickens and you suddenly develop arthritis, like it's definitely something to consider, especially if you're not in the age where arthritis would make sense.
So with that, what kind of autoimmune arthritis are we talking about? Like rheumatoid arthritis, or would it be something else?
No, it's called reactive arthritis.
Okay.
So there'd be some similarities with like rheumatoid arthritis, but you probably wouldn't have any of the blood markers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So it's not being tested for much, like routine tests at the doctor, maybe?
Probably not. I mean, I think if you mentioned that you had chickens, it'd be something that they consider. Like they could do antibody tests to see if you'd had Campylobacter. And it is, my understanding is it tends to be transient, so it's not going to last forever, like
Okay, that's
rheumatoid
good.
arthritis. But, you know, 6 months to a year is still a long time to have arthritis.
Definitely.
And the other thing that it can cause is this thing called partial, it's this called Guillain-Barré syndrome. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. It's an immune reaction that leads to like partial paralysis, sometimes complete paralysis. Yeah. So you can end up with some pretty serious temporary, and by temporary mean like 6 months to a year to possibly more than a year, issues from Campylobacter infection. And the two most common sources of Campylobacter infection in the US are drinking raw milk and eating poultry or contact with live poultry.
So for people who drink raw milk, then they can drink it. And I mean, I hear people say it a lot, you know, like, oh, it's fine, it doesn't bother me. I haven't noticed anything. And but they may get Campylobacter and not even realize they had it, and then they would have some weird thing come up, like the arthritis or the Guillain-Barré. I'm not sure how you say it either. I can't even remember how you said it, but yeah. And then if they have that, then they would be like, where did this come from? And man, that would be really difficult to pinpoint if you
Well,
didn't even know those
people
things could
kind of
come from that.
right, and people tend to blame like whatever they think is more likely. So you can get Guillain-Barré rarely from like side effects of certain vaccines. So depending on, you know, where your brain goes, people might be like, oh, I had a shingles vaccine. It's definitely the shingles vaccine. I actually know one of the local hatcheries I work with. The owner's husband has had Campylobacter twice, and she told me the first time that it was a diner where they ate over easy eggs. And the second time she thought it was celery. And at that point, I'm looking at her birds and I'm like, well, I mean, it could be, but I think it's possibly more likely that you've got work exposure here.
Possibly daily exposure to the bacteria.
Yeah, I mean, and some of her birds did test positive for Campylobacter, so
Oh.
yeah.
Well, and it's understandable. I mean, you know, that's how people's brains work. It's confirmation bias. So it's like
Oh, for
they want to believe what makes sense to them. And so, but at the same time, I think it's good just to talk about these things and for people to be aware that maybe it's not what they thought, you know, and that they might consider an alternative
For sure.
explanation.
Well, and the other thing is, if you go in to the doctors and it turns out you have Campylobacter and you've been drinking raw milk, I have some collaborations with the Vermont Department of Health on certain things, and one of them told me at one point that in Vermont, a big problem with tracing raw milk outbreaks, we don't have any on the books since 2015, but people come in with Campylobacter and they'll say, yeah, I drink raw milk, but then they won't tell anyone where they got it. And the State Department of Health can't force you, but if you Campylobacter and it might be raw milk, chances are somebody else's. And as much as you don't want to be the person putting your raw milk supplier out of business or temporarily, other people getting sick, like you might want to do something about that. Because it can be transient,
Goodness.
it could be one animal, it could be an issue of a lot of different things, but chances are you're not the only one. You just might be the only one who was sick enough to go in.
That makes me think that I might need to invite you back to talk just about raw milk because there are a ton of questions that I could ask about that, but I think we should stick to the
Yeah,
subject
it's
questions.
such a
But
tricky topic. But I grew up drinking raw milk, and it's one of the things I look back and go, maybe not the best life choice.
well, and I think a lot of people justify it by something that makes a lot of sense to me, and that you're being exposed to lots of good microbes in raw milk too. But there's a lot of potentially bad microbes in there
Right.
that.
I mean, if you want to be exposed to the good microbes, yogurt is possible is a definitely a safer choice and will give you most of those microbes.
It's true. And kefir
Or
also.
kefir. Yeah, really any fermented food is gonna do that for you.
I think, choosing the safer option that still will achieve the same goal is definitely the smart thing to do. So, I'm glad that we talked about that a little bit, and I think we might just need to talk about that a little bit more separately. But so when people are purchasing eggs and packaged chicken in the store, what should they be aware of? And is there any way to even tell that it has salmonella or
You
campylobacter?
cannot tell looking at poultry, unfortunately.
And smelling it?
No. So Salmonella and Campylobacter unfortunately won't produce any changes to the way the chicken looks or smells or tastes or feels. Like they don't cause spoilage.
So the spoilage microbes, because I mean, it's like I feel like if you've ever bought chicken and you didn't use it in time, it starts to smell. What is that growing? Is it like E. coli or something?
No, it's probably something completely different. I'm not an expert on spoilage microbes. The general rule of thumb is most spoilage microbes won't make you sick, and most foodborne pathogens won't cause spoilage. Now, that said,
That's interesting.
if you've left your chicken out on the counter 4 or 5 hours, you might be growing both. So, most foodborne pathogens don't grow well in the fridge, and spoilage organisms usually will. But if you've left it out at room temperature, like that's a different story.
Oh, that's interesting. That's something I really did not know, is that food spoilage organisms wouldn't necessarily, in general, make you sick.
Right. I
Because.
mean, for our ancestors, it was a really useful benchmark because if you didn't really have refrigeration, anything that's spoiled was probably also a higher risk for foodborne pathogens. But yeah, I mean, like usually if your milk has been refrigerated consistently, like if it's slightly sour, and you're desperate, like you can probably drink that and you can certainly use it in cooking. It just sort of depends on your tolerance for, I mean, this is talking about store-bought pasteurized milk. If it's raw milk, no, probably not a good idea because there are bacteria that can be in raw milk that can grow in the fridge that can make you sick. But they're not, they shouldn't be in pasteurized store milk unless something's gone really wrong.
So can, like, when let's talk about, like, the packaging.
Yeah.
Can Salmonella and Campylobacter be on the package itself?
Yes. So if you've got a package of chicken that is leaking, it's certainly possible for that to, you know, that juice leaking to have Salmonella and Campylobacter in it. This is where, like, the rules about cloth bags get really tricky. Because most of us do not wash our cloth bags regularly. So I generally have a particular bag that I use only for poultry. And if you have the option, or raw meat, if you have the option of putting your raw meat inside a plastic bag, a lot of meat sections will have those that you can use a twist tie on. It's a really good idea to do that, just to add that extra buffer. I don't think it's super common for there to be Salmonella or Campylobacter on the packaging, but especially if it's leaking, you know, all bets are off.
The one thing I do, something that I'm sure if people saw me in the grocery store, they'd be like, what is she doing? But I will take one of those bags and then I put it inside out over my hand, treat it like a glove, and I grab the package that I'm going to buy and then I pull it over top so that I don't have to touch the package at all.
A really great idea.
That's like my weird microbiology thing.
It makes total sense. My pet peeve is when the bags aren't really large enough to hold the entire piece of package and like tie them shut. And you're like, really? Now I'm going to put a second one over top and I still don't feel good about this, but oh well.
Yep. I know. Especially if, because I've definitely seen packages leak. The fact that you have, if you've seen a package leak, you know that packages could have leaked in transit as well and then dried, and then you don't know that it's on the outside.
Right. And so, this also brings me to a good point, which is chicken and other meats should always be at the bottom of your fridge. If unfortunately you have a fridge where the produce drawer is the bottom drawer, it's not great.
That's my refrigerator.
But anytime you're thawing meat in the fridge, one way to get around that is just to put a cookie sheet under it or put it in a bowl, just so that you don't have that meat juice leaking all over and maybe dripping down onto your fresh produce.
That's a good point. Yeah, and I always have a dedicated shelf too for meat, and I don't usually set other things on that shelf besides meat.
Especially if you're thawing like a turkey or something in the fridge.
Oh boy,
You know, thawing meat in the fridge is actually probably the safest way to do it. It just takes a lot longer. You know, you definitely need to make sure it's in a secondary container that is going to hold the juices.
So what are your thoughts on thawing at room temperature?
It's dicey. I actually have this discussion with my husband a lot because he likes to thaw at room temperature. One way you can get around this is to put it in like a bowl of water, because the water will sort of equalize the temperature and keep it cool. And it actually is more effective than thawing it in the air.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because that will help just keep the, so you're not going to have like, I guess, as you won't, it'll be less likely that you'll have like some spots in the middle that are still frozen. Probably if you do it in water, it might take a little bit longer, but.
No, I think it actually is faster a lot of times because the water is helping, you know, it's cool water, but it's, water conducts heat better than air, so you get better circulation.
Well, that's good. That's good to know. Okay, so let's move on to backyard chickens, because homesteading is definitely becoming more mainstream. It's not completely, but it is becoming more mainstream. You see a lot of stuff on Instagram, and I definitely have friends that have had backyard chickens, family that have done it too. So many people are doing it these days, and And your work definitely focuses on food safety in this regard. So for anyone who's interested in this, what are the microbiological risks involved? And we've kind of touched on this a little bit, but I'd like to hear more of your thoughts on it.
So it's tricky because I am, as far as I know, I'm the only person who's done like a really long study looking at multiple years in a row in the same place. Most people do like a year, maybe two. And I've been working on this since 2019. I have been working on the chick side of things since 2020. So we have 20, 20, 21, 22, 23. So we have 4 years of data. There's year-to-year variation. And that makes it kind of tricky to figure out, like, for any individual year, what are the risks. Adult backyard chickens definitely have a lot more variation than the babies, partly because the babies largely come from a core set of like a dozen to 20 hatcheries, mostly in the Midwest. Whereas the adults, I don't know, Vermont has chicken swaps. And, you know, so people buy chickens on Craigslist, people buy them at chicken swaps, people buy them at fairs. Interestingly enough, fairs seem to be one of the less common places to find chickens with salmonella. I'm not really sure why, but studies of poultry at fairs, you seem to find less salmonella. And we did some sampling at a fair this year and we didn't find any salmonella.
Wow.
Poultry swaps, on the other hand, tend to find a fair bit of salmonella.
Do you have an idea of why that might be? Any just, you know, hypotheses?
So a lot of times the show birds are really well cared for and really pampered, really healthy. I think they're probably less likely to be running around outside. The data varies a little bit year to year, but we generally find as much or slightly more salmonella in free-range rural poultry. And one of the possible reasons for this is that wild birds and wild animals can also have salmonella. So there's definitely the potential for cross spread. And one of the years we found the most salmonella was actually a year that there was an outbreak of salmonella in songbirds that included Vermont. So.
Okay, so they're a little more wild than the showbirds.
Yeah.
And so then they have more potential for exposure, I guess.
I think so. But feed, water, there's a lot of different ways. Other farm animals. Certainly, if you have a farm where you've got free-range chickens and goats and cows, or goats or cows and other animals, like certain, you know, there's definitely more potential for them to give salmonella to the cows or get salmonella from the cows or campylobacter, you know. You're just adding in a lot more variables, a lot more potential sources.
Well, something that I want to bring up and emphasize, though, is that even though this episode is really focused on pathogens a lot and the bad bacteria, but there have been studies that show that it's good to be exposed to animals and the outdoors and all these things. And so I don't want anyone to come away from this episode being afraid to raise backyard chickens or be afraid to, you know, have farm animals and have your kids be around them, because that actually the exposure to those animals has been shown to help kids develop a healthy immune system. So I just want to make sure that, you know, we don't walk away thinking something like, you know, drastic at the end. It's really it's more just to be aware of the possible, you know, pathogens right. that you can be exposed to.
So my goal is not to get anyone to get rid of their backyard poultry. I think they're great. I think chickens are a ton of fun. One of my neighbors has chickens. And we can hear them making noise a lot of mornings, and we call them the ladies and have a lot of fun listening to them, you know, singing their egg songs or whatever.
love that.
I don't know chickens because I don't use eggs enough. And I also really like flower gardening, and the two are not necessarily compatible. chickens are kind of notorious for ruining flower gardens if they're more free range. One of the big things I spend a lot of time thinking about is what are sort of the easy to implement high value practices that people can do to reduce the risk of getting salmonella while still enjoying their chickens.
That's really good. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
So there's a couple things to think about. One is, you know, don't kiss your chickens. Like, I get two reactions to that. One is, who in their right mind would kiss a chicken? And the other is, what do you mean I can't kiss my chickens? chickens dust bathe, and chickens are not picky about where they dust bathe, and salmonella can survive for a long time in dust. So if you're kissing your chicken, there's a decent chance you're getting some dried poop on your face, which is really gross, but accurate. Holding the chicken, petting the chicken, these are lower risk than kissing the chicken. So if you want to enjoy your chicken, just keep the chicken away from your face. That, along with that, hand washing after handling chickens or eggs or doing farm chores is going to be really important. And just, you know, common code, like some of the stuff we learned during COVID, like don't, you know, try to keep your hands away from your face. If you're doing your farm chores, you know, maybe don't, you know, rub your face. And a big one is, like, if you have a coop you can walk into, have a set of designated coop shoes, especially if you have small kids that are in the age where they're crawling around on the floor. This is going to, if you keep your shoes in a place where they can't access and don't wear those around your house, this is going to be a big factor in reducing the risk of salmonella for small children. Speaking of small children, like, supervise your kids around the chickens. Maybe don't let them go play with the chickens in their pajamas. You know, keep an eye on it. They can hold the chickens. They shouldn't be kissing the chickens. They can feed the chickens. They can have their little mud boots that they wear in the coop. Chickens are a really great project, but kids are also at a little bit of a higher risk. So, you know, try to balance those two things. And chicks, oh boy, kids love chicks.
Who doesn't?
I know, but kids especially love chicks. So if you are buying baby chicks, put them in an area that you can control access to. So that when the kids have access to those chicks, you're there and you're keeping an eye on things and they're not, like, rubbing the chick all over their face. This also is especially good if you've got toddlers who may not know, like, how hard they can hold a chick. You don't really want them accidentally squeezing a chick to death either. Don't keep your chicks in the kitchen or your bedroom. Because there's a lot of dust, and that dust can contain salmonella. But, you know, if you have a spare room, if you have a basement, these are great options. And on that note, you know, like, don't wash out your chicken stuff in your kitchen sink. And maybe not your bathroom sink either. The bathtub might be a better option. And if you get ducks, as cute as it sounds, do not do kid pictures with a little duck in live duck in the bathtub with your kid. It is a good way to get salmonella. Another State Department of Health story, but yes, I definitely had a case where people had ducks and chickens, you know, baby ducks and chickens, and they stuck the baby duck in the bathtub with the kid. Salmonella ensued.
Oh boy.
Yeah, I mean, baby ducks, okay. Baby chicks are really messy, but baby ducks, if you want a mess, buy baby ducks, because they will throw the water all over their little pen, and it will turn into a soup of shavings and poop and water, and I don't know how they're so messy, but they are the messiest creatures. So, they're really cute, but they are so messy.
That's funny.
They're like the pig and a baby poultry.
Yeah, it's like you don't think about them as being like pigs.
Yeah.
They're so cute.
They're like the pig pen from Charlie Brown, just walking around with that.
Yeah.
Constant,
like, pig pen. Yeah. That's funny. Are there any other tips you have?
Those are the kind of the main ones. I'd say the other thing is like clean your coop regularly. And if you have bedding that's really dusty, it might be a good time to pull out some of those COVID masks that you probably have hanging around, like even the cloth ones, while you're cleaning, so that you're not inhaling that dust.
Mm.
Like a salmonella in it. It's not a bad plan. Like, you don't necessarily need to like grab latex gloves or something, but you know, just from like a grossness factor, like maybe not inhaling the dried poop is a good thing. Yeah, like for the eggs, the more you keep your nest boxes clean, the easier it'll be to clean off the eggs. One thing that's interesting is that the CDC actually, and I think the USDA actually, recommend that you don't wash the eggs from your backyard poultry, because if the water temperature is off, you can kind of pull things in from the outside. If they're really dirty, they actually recommend using like steel wool, which is sort of random, but... Yeah, it's definitely an option.
Okay, well, is there anything about your work that you think people tend to misunderstand or that you'd like to clear up that you haven't mentioned yet?
I think people assume I get really paranoid, which there's a certain extent to which familiarity breeds contempt. And, I mean, when I teach food safety classes, there's one I teach on outbreaks, and the students in the class always start off, you know, because they're college students. And at first they get really scared because they're realizing all these things they never thought could make them sick could make them sick.
Mm.
And then by the end of the semester, they've sort of gone, oh, just about anything could make me sick. And best case scenario, they've sort of figured out what the high risk stuff is and prioritized. Worst case scenario, they've decided nothing matters. Everything's going to get me sick. I might as well just keep doing what I was doing. So it's the big thing to think about risks and food safety is, what is the actual risk? Can I live with it? What do I need to be concerned about? And what is my risk level? You know, if I study, in addition to Salmonella and Campylobacter, I study Listeria. And now that I'm expecting my first child, like, I spend a lot of time thinking about Listeria because it can cause miscarriages. Mm-hmm. But I also, you know, have to sort of compartmentalize a little bit because I don't want to actually go insane. As I'm like, oh, well, should I eat salad? Should I eat apples? Mm-hmm. Should I eat, like, anything could have Listeria? Yeah, not great to actually lose your mind from stress.
Yeah. Well, that kind of brings up the point about risk assessment, which is something that I talked to Dr. Sandra Wilkes about in a previous episode, so I'll link to that. But we went in depth about that idea of how important it is to really get educated on this stuff so that you're not just like, oh my gosh, everything, you know, or I'm scared or whatever, but knowing what you need to actually be concerned about, how to deal with it. Just like we talked about the backyard chickens, it's great to have them. We're not saying not have them, but just know what to be a little bit more careful about.
Yeah. And I'd say one scenario where maybe you shouldn't have backyard chickens is if you have a child with like an autoimmune disorder or cancer, like maybe not the best plan. because they're going to be really vulnerable.
Yeah, immunocompromised. That's definitely something to consider. And then I wonder for the elderly, too, if that's just something that they should, I don't know if that's as much of a concern or not, but just as you're aging.
It's definitely something to consider. I'd say if you've always had backyard poultry, you're probably better off. But if you're, 85 and your health is iffy and you're on something that maybe suppresses your immune system, or you have an organ transplant, or you're in the middle of cancer treatment, maybe not the best time to buy chickens.
So is there anything else you'd like to mention that you haven't had a chance to yet?
Oh, that's a good question. I do have a blog that I don't keep very updated, but it has a lot of information on backyard poultry. I'm just looking up the exact address.
Yeah, that'll be one of the resources I'll definitely link to in the show notes.
Right. So it's blog.uvm.edu/aedder. And we do have some information on there if you live in the New England area on how to participate in our backyard poultry studies. We do offer people the option of shipping in soil bedding. You probably won't. We can detect that there had been Campylobacter, but we can't grow it from that. But usually we can grow Salmonella from that. And we do give people their results. We've published, I think there are some summaries on there of what we found different years, layman's version of our most recent publication. So yeah, it's a good resource, and it links to a lot of other resources on that as well.
So briefly, what have you learned from your work that has changed how you think about microbes in your daily life?
I think I've realized, because I grew up homesteading and we basically did almost everything I don't recommend doing. And I've realized that there's a certain amount of luck and individual susceptibility. So the risk is not super consistent. It's kind of like the people who we probably all know who took like no precautions and somehow never have gotten COVID, and the other people who were like KN95s, gloves, never went anywhere and somehow still got COVID. There is just some random dumb luck that gets in the way. And the other thing I've learned is that one thing that I think drives people nuts about science is that we think it's really settled, but it isn't. My job is actually to figure out what things we think are true aren't. And every time I teach food microbiology or food safety courses, there are so many things in the last 10 years we thought, oh, bacteria can't grow there, or that's not a food safety risk. And then there was an outbreak. And you're like, okay, so, it's hard. Like COVID was really hard because you want answers. Everybody wants answers. And the answers kept changing. But that's also the nature of science. So I think one of the things I've learned is just I love the fact that science is evolving all the time. But I also realize just how frustrating that is for the average person who just wants an answer.
I think that's a really good point.
It depends. And that's not
I know. It depends. The famous words of scientists.
Yes. And there's a reason we say it that way, because we don't
know.
Be dogmatic about something that might change next year.
Oh, I know. There seems to always be exceptions, too. There's always the weird, oddball microbes that do things the opposite way.
Or the places that you're like, there's not going to be that bacteria there. And it's like, surprise.
There it is. Yep. Besides your blog, do you have any other resources that you would recommend so listeners can go deeper on this topic? Because this is a huge topic. So, yeah.
Right. I mean, I think if you're really curious, this is a resource I use in all my classes in lieu of a textbook. The FDA put out what they call their bad bug book, and it's free for download. It's not super technical. Not all of the information is up to date because it's from 2013, but it is a good resource if you're curious to learn more about it.
That's great. Well, where can everyone find, follow, and connect with you?
So I'm on Twitter, which is dying. I have a Facebook page. What is it called? UVM. If you Google UVM, like University of Vermont, Food Microbiology Laboratory, Vermont Backyard Chickens. Again, not super up to date, but it's there. I occasionally post stuff about this on Instagram. What is my Instagram handle? I was keeping up with this more last year. It'll probably be kept up more in the future.
I looked at your Facebook page and it does have some good graphics on there and information. So I think that'll be really good for anyone who wants to know more about.
And I think that one also links to the blog, which has the most information. You should be able to see the old blog posts, and it definitely is interesting to watch how the project has evolved and what we know about it has changed.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if you want to, you can just send me your Instagram handle, and then I'll link to that as well.
That sounds good.
So, but thank you so much for sharing all of this with us. This has been super interesting. I've learned a lot, and I think that I love that, you know, we discussed all these things that people might find really scary, but then also talked about how important it is to assess the risks and still enjoy these activities despite the fact that there are risks. So, and I think that's how a lot of things are. A lot of really cool things in life have risks, and we have to go through that process of risk assessment. So thank you so much, and I appreciate your time.
Yeah, you're welcome. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Joyful Microbe Podcast. Please subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. If you'd like to help others who love microbes to find the podcast, then please leave a rating and a review for the show. And tell a friend. To learn more about the Joyful Microbe, head on over to joyfulmicrobe.com, where you will find the show notes and all the links and resources mentioned. If you love Joyful Microbe and would like to support the show, you can do so by leaving a virtual tip through Ko-fi. The link is in the show notes and on joyfulmicrobe.com at the bottom of the page. Thanks again, microbe friends. Talk to you next time.